For the benefit of our TV audience, I thought I should introduce myself. Several people ask, who are you? And so for the TV audience, I am who I am, that is Walt Pilgrim, and I do direct the Lutheran Institute for Theological Education. What a humbling experience that is. Okay. We are blessed with an abundance of bishops, present, past, and future. Now, I'd like to get specific about future, but I'll let you think about that overnight. But I did overlook two past bishops in our midst, and that is Tom Blevins. Tom, would you please stand? And I saw Don Meyer. Don Meyer? Where? There he is. Good. We have a number of regional representatives here, and I'd like them to be recognized as well. We have Ron Cohen, our regional coordinator. Ron? Is he here? Oh, he did. Okay. Bob Armstrong, regional director of stewardship. There they are. And Tom Blevins could take another bow with the Conference of Bishops and Division of Ministry. Kathy Brosh, Division of Outreach Staff. Kathy? Ted Hutchinson, I don't know if many of you have gotten to know him yet, but Director for Multicultural Ministry. Ted. Good. For the benefit of TV audiences, yes, don't forget. Cindy Lau, Director of Communications, did Cindy? No? Where? Okay, she's coming. She's on the phone, all right? And Stacy Kitahati, who comes from the National Office, Division for Global Mission. Stacy, would you? And then from way far away, we have a Canadian contingent here. And I think we should recognize our Canadian brothers and sisters. Would they stand, please, and let's see who they are. Please. Okay. Have we forgotten anyone? Okay. Yes. Montana, would you please stand? Yeah, there we go. Shepherdless though you be, okay. That's biblical. Okay. If there are among you persons interested in, maybe that's quite the way to say it, persons who might be interested in morning Eucharist, early morning Eucharist, say around 7 o'clock, if you might be interested in that, see me after this session, and I think we can try and accommodate that kind of wish. Okay? Early morning Eucharist. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our second guest lecturer. As you know, one of the key theological issues in the ELCA is the doctrine of ministry. Lutherans have been very ambivalent on this topic, wavering somewhat between what we could call a high view of ministry as an office ordained of God to a more functional view as arising out of the needs within the people of God. Notice how I resisted calling it a low view of ministry. I would say I wanted someone who might help us direct our reflections on ourselves as called and ordained servants of the Word, and or as persons set aside for special offices such as deacons or associates in ministry. I met Phyllis about a year ago when she told me that she had spoken at a pastoral conference when she had raised some significant questions and issues on this topic. And so I invited her to come immediately to our Holden conference and speak to us with maybe a revised or updated or edited version of what she had done. And she, after some prodding, agreed to come. Dr. Anderson is a native here in the West Coast, grew up in San Francisco. Then she attended Concordia Teachers College in Nebraska and San Francisco State College and received her BA from Sacramento State. She received an MDiv from Wartburg Theological Seminary in Dubuque. I would hardly agree with that, okay? And also holds a PhD in systematic theology from Aquinas Institute of Theology. And her dissertation was entitled, listen to this, Power and Ministry, a theological examination of the relationship between power and servanthood in Christian ministry in view of the ordination of women. It's a long title, Phyllis, but I'm sure. She was ordained in 1978, and she served several pastorates, and then was called as assistant to the bishop of the Iowa district of the ALC. And then she was called to the faculty of the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago as director of pastoral studies. And in January 1988, she assumed her present position as director for theological education in the division for ministry of the ELCA. And so it's in that capacity in particular that we've asked you to come here and to speak with us about ministries to meet the mission. And as you heard tonight, her subject is Adiaphora That Matters. So let's give a warm welcome to Phyllis Anderson.
Greetings to you from Chicago. You don't hear that every day. And particularly from Madeline Bussey and James Moy, who work in the division for ministry with me and with Tom Blevins, who's our deployed staff out here. It is the Pacific Northwest is certainly not underrepresented in the division for ministry, or we have stolen richly from you. Neither. I don't know how many of you here are from the Missouri Synod tradition. You blew my cover by saying I had gone to Concordia Seward. Four of us in the division come out of the Missouri Synod heritage in one way or another. They happen to be the four people who are responsible for candidacy and theological education. I bring you greetings also from Paul Nelson, the director of the study. He or members of his task force and members of our central staff will be here in the Pacific Northwest for 3 days next week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, I believe, for hearings on the study of ministry. I'm grateful for this invitation. I'm not always grateful when I first get it, and there's probably not time to do the kind of preparation one would hope for a group like this in the kind of work I'm doing now. But I think it's good for us to meet like this. I am grateful for the occasion to read a few books. I'm grateful for the occasion to come clean, to express publicly the kind of thinking people in the bureaucracy of our church are doing about issues of ministry. I think those things ought to be said out in the open. You ought to know the minds who are giving a lot of attention to these issues. There's lots going on in our division right now, from writing expectations of pastoral ministry to funding of seminaries. And I hope there'll be informal time for us to talk and answer questions and get ideas and whatnot. I think I'm up tomorrow night for the fireside talk, and I look forward to conversations with you about the work of the division. I will give three lectures under this general topic of the ministry to meet the missions. The first one this evening will be about the issues and questions facing the study of ministry, and try to get a handle on why it is so hard for us as Lutherans. As Walt said, we have been ambivalent. And I think it's worth spending some time tonight exploring why it is that we are so ambivalent and so slow to make decisions. 6 years is a long time we've cut out for ourselves for this one. The second focus for tomorrow night will be on mission, on the purpose of ministry, and ways in which how ministry is structured either functions to help or impede the mission that we say we're about. And the third lecture will explore possible new forms of ministry. Those are issues facing the study of ministry. What kind of forms of ministry are possible within our Lutheran polity, which will respond appropriately to the current mission or even the malaise that we have in our culture? I hope you all have a little handout, a little ecologically sound, tiny handout. There's only one. There's probably not more than one apiece, and there's no more tomorrow. I'd ask you to bring it back tomorrow. We're going to deal with those categories in both lectures. If you didn't get one, there at both doors coming in, there ought to be enough for each to have their own. The Commission for a New Lutheran Church, after struggling to come to a common definition of ministry in the ELCA, determined that a number of key issues related to the definition, the practice, the structuring, the nitty-gritty of ministry should best be left for study and recommendation by the ELCA itself following the formation of the new church. A continuing resolution in the Constitution establishes the study of ministry as an early priority in the life of the church by making the following recommendation, and I'm going to read that to you. During the period of 1988 to 1994, that has since been foreshortened to 1993 because I don't think we have a churchwide assembly in 94, so it's been cut a year short. This church shall engage in an intensive study of the nature of ministry, leading to decisions regarding appropriate forms of ministry that will enable this church to fulfill its mission. During the course of such study, a special attention will be given to 1, the tradition of the Lutheran Church, or traditions may have been more appropriate, 2, the possibility of articulating a Lutheran understanding and adaptation of the threefold ministerial office of bishop, pastor, and deacon and its ecumenical implications, and 3, the appropriate forms of lay ministries to be officially recognized and certified by this church, including criteria for certification, relationships to synods, and discipline, an area that people in this region seem to be more well aware of than in some other places of the church, that it really needs attention. In a recent article in Dialogue, George Lindbeck offers his predictions regarding the ELCA study of ministry. He doesn't expect much. Certainly no surprises. The basic decisions that the task force will recommend, he concludes at the start, are predictable and inconsequential. Let me quote. Barring some improbable eventualities, it does not make much difference what the outcome is. Certain constitutional issues need to be settled one way or another, but how they are settled is of secondary importance. The faithfulness of the ELCA to the gospel is not at stake, and the work of the ministry will not be much affected for either good or ill. One might ask then, especially in the kind of financial situation that we're in now and the kind of time pressures I feel myself under, why are we taking 6 years to do this, or five? Why then was the CNLC unable to decide these issues in an efficient and timely way? If the answers are predictable and inconsequential, why didn't they save this new church the time and expense that it will take to solve them? If the answers are predictable and inconsequential, why must associates in ministry hang in limbo for 5 or 6 years? And why do they care so desperately about how it's decided? If the answers are predictable and inconsequential, why is it that ministry questions are the ones that divide us from the other communions of Christendom? Our ecumenical dialogues break down at this point. Why, if it doesn't matter? If the answers are predictable and inconsequential, why are people and pastors and congregations so often confused and angry about their respective roles? If the answers are predictable and inconsequential, where are the indigenous leaders that we need to evangelize and teach in communities that are out of the mainstream? Where are the ministries that we need that maybe need to be done by people who do not have a 4-year theological education, or ministries that might even be impeded by 4 years at a Lutheran seminary? And if we were to be able to raise up those leaders, what would we call them? And how would we bless them, support them? How would they be held accountable? If the answers are predictable and inconsequential, why are people so intent on getting their issues before the task force? Paul Nelson gets more mail than the rest of us put together, and I think people will go great distances next week to make sure that their concerns come before the hearing on the study of ministry. Obviously, I and a few other folks are expecting, or at least hoping, for much more from the study of ministry than George Lindbeck is. Maybe we will get some of the answers we seek, and maybe we won't. I think it's very important, and it was worth reading what we've set out to do so that we don't get an exalted opinion of what it's even intended to do. But George Lindbeck has been around for a long time. He is very wise and very realistic. There are powerful reasons for not resolving the perennial questions about ministry. And we'll talk about a few of them. One of the powerful reasons for not finally settling down and resolving the perennial questions about ministry is that Scripture itself doesn't. There's no clear blueprint in Scripture that would give us that kind of authority to say this is how it should be for all time. The confessions intentionally leave questions of ministry rather widely open. At least they refuse to mandate forms and structures of ministry for all times and all places. Christians may differ on ceremonies and organizational matters, but those who preach must be rightly called. So even within the confessions themselves, there are tensions that are not easily resolved. As Lindbeck says, the faithfulness of the ELCA to the gospel is not at stake. These are matters of adiaphora, But I will say more emphatically tomorrow there are adiaphora which matter. We could make it easy if these issues really are predictable and inconsequential, and if there's no clear scriptural mandate, and if the confessions waffle a bit. It ought to be possible to just decide, well, let's just say we're going to all do it one way for a while. But there are powerful reasons for not resolving it. There are powerful traditions and strong emotional fixations about styles and forms of ministry that are not strictly rational and do not yield easily to reasoned argumentation. Aesthetics, politics, piety also shape the strongly held convictions that we hold in our own ways, and we don't know how they all got there. Some of them are just how we grew up. But we believe somehow that it's right that God should order the church into ranks like a mighty, well-uniformed army. Or we really believe that the Spirit bubbles up from below and leaps over clerical barriers. Those are convictions deeply held. But finally, ministry unavoidably, and we would really like to avoid it, finally, ministry has elements of authority and power clinging to it, at least to the structures of ministry. And that, I think, underneath is what we keep arguing about. I think that is the most compelling reason why we do not resolve the perennial issues of ministry. When we rearrange the structures of ministry, however noble, theological, mission-minded, service-oriented we are, we are also in a process that is going to affect who has position, voice, and status. We're talking about power and authority, and most of us are not very comfortable in that realm, and we don't do it cleanly or decisively. I think it is authority that is the stumbling block when we talk about ministry. Those who hold power, and most of us in this room probably hold more power than we think we do, would rather not talk about it. When the discussion gets open and decisions are made, like perhaps they will be made in this study of ministry, for those who have power or authority, there is the chance of losing some. And simply in the process of talking about it, unmasking it, putting out in front of people, taking away some of the mystique, I think there is probably a perceived loss in authority just in the opening up the question. We are pretty good, better at least, about talking about authority and power in strictly theological terms, which usually means referring to the limits that are placed on human power and authority. Ministry has authority in theological terms because, as we say in the Augsburg Confession, Article 5, it is instituted by God. We make that affirmation, but it lacks specificity. It's hard to find a New Testament scholar who will say that Jesus instituted anything like the ministry that we know today in the pastoral office. It is disputed whether the ministry referred to in Augustana 5 refers to the ministry of the baptized, who all participate in word and sacrament, or to the ministry of the ordained. We get from that instituted by God that the clear idea, the clear theological understanding that whatever else happens, whatever forms, whatever structures, there must finally be a ministry. And that idea is God's idea. Whether or not God can be said to work directly through any specific form of ministry to the exclusion of others. But we do make those affirmations on the basis of that phrase from the confessions. We also say theologically and with conviction and repeat and exhort one another again and again that ministry is service. It's what the word means. Whoever would be great among you must be the least of all and the servant of all. Hans Küng says in his classic book on ministry that one of the marks of ministry is that it is diaconal, it is service. Service opposed to any kind of dominion. Lording it over, he says, along with the Gospel of Mark, lording it over others has no place in Christian ministry. If it becomes domineering, if our ministries become domineering, they're no longer ministry by his definition. And if ministerial power and authority is used for the good of God's people, then we no longer call that power and authority. We simply refer to that as the service of ministry itself. Servant leadership, while a powerful dialectic and one that I hope controls your ministries, often masks and obfuscates what's actually going on in terms of power dynamics. And the kind of classic phrase for me is, I think, from the 6th century, the popes of Rome, no matter what level of political and secular power they gained in the world, were referred to as the servants of God. That is a powerful corrective, and I hope they never stop saying that, and they may have moved towards that, but it's not the whole story of what's going on. The third theological affirmation that we as Lutherans, Lutheran Christians, seem to be comfortable about making about power or about the authority of the pastoral office is that the only power going on there is really God working through us. The power is not our own. That was, it is the Word. God's word, God's own self-authenticating word, which convicts. It is the Spirit which brings to faith. Preaching is the viva vox of God. The word of God establishes its own intrinsic power to do what it claims to us and for us. To end the old and begin the new, to create faith, to set us free, to liberate us from the law, sin, and death, those are words of Luther. It's what he says God does when a person preaches, and it's God's doing. So the power is great, but it is not the power of the minister, but the power of the word. It's God's power. We are the media. Like Balaam's ass, we are the mouth through which God's word can be heard. And I do believe that. However true that may be, and theologically, I don't think we'd get much argument here on any of those affirmations that we make about how power and authority work in ministry and how God's power is active in ministry. But that's not all that's going on in ministry. My experience tells me that there is authority in the ministry, authority that people exercise in relationship to one another. People who are under authority are usually very clear where the authority is. They can tell you pretty clearly how it works. But we, by and large, are skittish about talking about power and authority in that specific sociological, phenomenological sort of frame and reference of what's actually going on in human terms. I served a three-point parish in Epworth, Dyersville, and Earlville, Iowa. I was in a team ministry. There were two of us, a pastor close to 50, and I was right out of seminary, although I wasn't. I suppose I was second career, but I was young and inexperienced by comparison. We were put together to be co-pastors out of somebody's wisdom of three churches. And there were power dynamics involved. Pastor Bob was of the tradition of the church that didn't put much store by the trappings of clerical authority. He did not own a clerical collar. He wore a choir robe until sometime in our ministry together. He always said to people, just call me Bob. He did not chair the church council, nor did he chair committee meetings. He would not come with an agenda. And I, right out of seminary, was wound up like a top, and I did desperately want to be called Pastor Anderson once in a while. And I tried to dress the part, and however long we were there, he continued to be called Pastor Wessels, and I continued to be called Phyllis. And and I came with my little agendas and was open about learning how to chair meetings, and darned if he didn't always get his way. In human terms, he was able to exercise enormous authority in that situation, and I expect his authority was more effective in that setting, and possibly unchecked and unaccountable, because it was he was only being the servant of the people. Another story I'd like to tell from that time in ministry that makes me think there is some authority inherent in the office. It seems as though for men in ministry at this point are most keenly aware of the loss of authority that seems to be true of the pastoral office. I think for women coming newly into parish ministry, it is a kind of upward mobility and a level of authority that they have never experienced before. I was out on a little country road in the winter, and in the first car I'd owned myself, and I went in the ditch, and a farmer pulled me out, and all the lights were blazing on the dashboard, and we checked a few things out, and it seemed like there wasn't anything really wrong with the car. It was just fuses or something that make the lights go on. Well, I'll never do that again. I went about 5 miles and blew up the engine. The oil pan had been punctured when we went into the ditch. And I was quite a ways from nowhere, or from Delaware, Iowa, to be exact. And I, and it was very cold. And by the time I got there, it's a very small town, and things were pretty closed up. And there was one little shop, kind of a general store, and it was closed too, but I knocked. I could see there were people in the back room talking. It took a long time before anyone would come out and deal with me, and when a woman finally came, by then I was a sheet of mucus, crying and upset about the car. Someone Well, I had a pretty good idea that it was pretty serious by then. And I asked her if I could use the phone, and she said, there's a pay phone just a few blocks down. So I screwed up my courage and went down, and of course it was out of order. So I was humiliated into coming back and knocking on the door and bringing her out from the back room. And she did allow me to come in out of the cold and use the phone. And there were, in fact, four or five women sitting in this little back room having coffee and cookies. And I stood by the phone and cried and called my husband, and it was going to be a half an hour before a tow truck could come, and so I was in this horrible position of being in this kitchen with these women, and I couldn't stop crying. And one of them said to the other, and they paid no attention to me at all, one of them said to the other, who's going to put the candle in the eternal light? And I said, I bet you're Lutheran. And they said, yes, they were from the Lutheran church in that community. I said, well, I'm Phyllis Anderson. I'm pastor in the next town. Well, the atmosphere in that room changed so quickly. The cookies came out, you know, they were concerned about my car and me and my husband and the tow truck, which is, one can be cynical about that. I was more aware of what happened to myself. I stopped crying like that. I was empowered by that moment of recognition. And I was able to talk to them about the call process of the new pastor who was coming. I found myself saying things like, well, you know, it's only a car, you know. So I am keenly aware that there is power, empowerment, there is a lot going on in human terms. I'm not saying God wasn't present in that exchange. It's been a gold mine of illustrative material, if nothing else. But when I say that, and when I even admit that I kind of enjoy that, and that I function better, and am able to serve better, within a context where my authority is recognized, I am challenged by those who would call that the sin in me, and I don't know. I am challenged by serious feminist sisters and critics who more emphatically than Hans Küng or Martin Luther say that we must eradicate any traces of authority in ministry, and who would say that my stories reveal not truth about God or about ministry, but more about me and my sin. In a new book, I don't know if you've seen, Pillar of Flames, Power, Priesthood, and Spiritual Maturity by Maggie Ross, is the most radical thing I have come across in this line of reasoning. She radically disassociates priesthood, which is a life of spiritual self-emptying in conformity with Christ, true servanthood, not rhetoric of servanthood. She distinguishes that from what she calls career administration-oriented ministry, which I'm afraid is what most of us are into. The two, she says, are necessary and complementary, but absolutely incompatible. If I may quote from her, we must render distinct these two models of power. For the most part, they cannot beneficially coexist in the same human being, from the point of view either of the congregation or the clergy themselves. The true priest, she says, cannot be a paid position, and the called, stipended, ordained pastor should not be entrusted with ministry of word and sacrament. Now that is as bold a challenge as I have come across, that should be the gift reserved to this spiritual priesthood, which are not, whose minds are not fogged by these illusions of power. Maggie Ross is an Anglican solitary who has refused offers of American bishops to ordain her. She identifies with the non-stipendiary, non-administrative spiritual priesthood. And yet, in my reading, and maybe this is just how I get off the hook, in my reading, she is not innocent of power. See, she would like the whole church to think as she does and come over to her point of view. She insists, and I quote, "Education for priesthood, as she defines it, must be mandatory for all." I have heard too many of us say things like, well, when we take over the church, we're not going to do these power games. But the critique sticks in my craw, and I mean to take it very seriously. Another new book by Lynn Rhodes, based on the experience of women pastors, not Lutheran, co-creating a feminist vision of ministry, rightly holds up a vision of the church which empowers all its members, which is intimate, relational, honest, vulnerable, which is communal, a kind of corrective to the rugged individualism that we were talking about earlier today. But it seems clear again that to make such an eventuality come to pass, it's going to take changing a lot of people's minds. And that, I'm afraid, is an extraordinary exercise of power. Even if it's done gently, kindly, non-invasively, communally, and not as self-serving individualism. So while I am challenged by the radical purity of their vision, and while I know I am treading on thin ice, and I know I am co-opted at every turn, and I know I am vulnerable to be defensive of the bureaucracy and all that I come to represent now, but seems to me that in order to understand ministry, to study it, make decisions about it, design it to meet the mission, we had better be pretty clear about how power works, what it does for people and to people and among people. And we're better off doing that in the most neutral, non-pejorative, non-inflated, scientific, sociological kind of way. And to that end, I have provided you with this little chart, which I'm afraid some of you have seen it before. It has been invaluable to me in getting some clarity on how authority works. I'm going to go through it briefly in as neutral, non-judgmental a way as I can. We'll use it again tomorrow, and after we've talked about the purpose of ministry and the values and the restrictions and the delimiters that we as Christians must put on power, then we'll come back and look at this again and evaluate it in terms of what sources of authority are appropriate for Christians and for people in ministry. But I just want to get this before you tonight. The definition is important. There's many, and you may have other favorite definitions that you could quote. I'd ask you for this one's not bad, and it's worth going with in order for us to get on to some other places. Power is the capacity of some persons to produce intended and foreseen effects on others. And I propose that we do earnestly intend to have effects on other people, and that you were called to ministry in order to affect other people. In the author, the sociologist from whom I have borrowed this is Dennis Wrong, and the book I think I've given at least a partial reference is Power, Its Forms, Bases, and Uses. It came out in something like 1982. Power, somehow calling it influence, takes some of the sting out of it for me. And I suppose it could be said we're influencing people all the time, whether we know it or not. I may be violently turning off somebody in the back row by the way I've curled my hair that I have no idea about, and I certainly didn't intend. But we're probably most of the influence that's going on, most of the time, we don't intend, so it doesn't make much use to talk about them. The focus of power, if we can define it and understand how it works, we're going to restrict ourselves to those things that we do intend to affect. So that's the reason for the use, intended and foreseen effects. Power, Dennis Wrong would always also say, is always asymmetrical. Somebody always has more than somebody else in any given transaction. I may say to my child, you're gonna have peanut butter and jelly for lunch today, and I am in the authority position for that moment. That doesn't mean I always am. If the child kicks and screams and throws his food on the floor, he has exerted power also. Power can be mutual, but in any discrete action, somebody always has more than another. That's where the influence comes in. It can go back and forth, but it's not simply shared. I want to make it crisper than that. You don't have to be exercising power all the time to be powerful. It can be latent. I can, as a police officer, I don't have to be getting my gun out all the time and telling people what to do. If just driving past in the patrol car is enough to make me slow down. And the other caution about, as we get into these different forms of power, this is just a schema. I have found it enormously useful. It has made sense of lots of ministry situations I've been in. But it is, like all schema, it's something that's laid on experience, and what's really going on is much more complicated than the categories by which I'm going to encourage you to think about things. And usually, two or three of these sources of authority are operating at the same time. I've said power, another way of talking about power is to say it's the influence that some people have over others. There are many ways in which one can come to have that power over one another. On the extreme left on your paper, force is probably the most blatant, fearsome sort of exhibition of power. It's power based on might, creation of physical obstacles restricting the freedom of another, the infliction of bodily pain or injury, including destruction of life, frustration of basic biological needs. If I am able to cover your mouth with a and keep you from getting air, I have enormous power over you. I can keep you real still. There's a limit to what I can make you do, but I can certainly stop you. So force is probably what we think of as a model of power when we say power is something I don't think we as Christians should have anything to do with. Another way of having influence over others is through manipulation. That's influence based on deceit. That's if I tell you what I intend for you, but I don't tell you all of what I intend for you, and you wind up falling into my trap under false pretenses, I have manipulated you into doing something you want. Sometimes that can be beneficial. You know, we tell kids that if they eat their spinach, they'll have curly hair. Well, how much harm is done if they don't get curly hair? The important thing is that they got the spinach done. I think advertising is one of the ways in which whole populations are manipulated to do things, and they don't know exactly why. Persuasion is another way of influencing people to have an effect on them. It is influence based on reason, through reason discourse, through sharing of information, statistics, logical sequence. You can convince people to do what you wish they would do. I think many of us feel like we're doing this most of the time, and there are probably other things operative while we are engaged in reasoned discourse. We also tend to think that persuasion is more fair because you're dealing with minds and people can talk back. It's certainly a lot more fair than bopping someone over the head. But it is, we are not all equally equipped with information or rhetorical skill for carrying on the kind of discussion that leads to persuasion. But that is another way in which we help people to do the thing that we want them to do. And the fourth that's listed in wrong schema here is authority. I've said we force works because of might, manipulation works because of deceit, persuasion works because of reason, authority works because of trust. Authority is the capacity of some persons to produce these effects on others because of who they are and because of the trust other people place in them. And there are, in these, in the lines shooting down from authority, are listed five reasons why people might trust someone enough to do what they say. And I will do these very quickly, because worship is in 3 minutes, right? But we will come back to this. I just want to make sure it's in your working in your mind. You might do what somebody says because you trust that they could harm you if you don't. And we call that coercive authority. So I was thinking about it this time through. It may be that in the frame of reference I work in now, candidacy committees have coercive authority. They can decide someone will not be ordained. A policeman also has coercive authority. Induced authority is effective because you trust the person who asked you to do something, because you believe, you trust that they can help you. In these circles, I think bishops of the church certainly have induced authority for those who are seeking calls. There are many ways in which those operate. We'll talk more about them tomorrow. But it is I think these first two are reward and punishment. The third is legitimate authority, and that's not meant to be a value judgment, although I'm personally rather fond of it. It is the authority of office. You're inclined to do what the person says because you trust them, because you have made a kind of social contract that says they are in an appropriate position to make the kind of directives that we're making. A officer in the army would be probably the prime example of legitimate authority. You obey the officer because he's the officer. And I think traditionally pastors have enjoyed more of this authority than they presently feel like they do. Competent authority is when you do what a person says because you trust that they know what they're doing. Now, when you see a doctor, you tell them about your indigestion and the doctor gives you a prescription, you're inclined to take it. He doesn't have to persuade you by rational discourse exactly how this is going to work in your body. Some of us ask for that. But most of us are willing to accept on trust that this person has been to medical school, they know better than I do, I'll do what they say. We have some of that operating for us as pastors too. People really think you know some things that they don't know. And the final is personal authority, wherein you're inclined to do what a person says because you like them and want to please them. And I think you enjoy some of that in the ministries that you do. Probably the longer you're at a place, you're operating more in that range of authority and less dependent on the legitimate authority of your office. That kind of authority is operative in personal relationships from falling in love, where you do anything for the other person, to people taking cyanide-laced Kool-Aid in Georgetown. Because of that strong attachment to the leader that makes you trust them and want to please them and not disappoint them. These different forms, sources of authority, are not specifically Christian. I think some of them are more appropriate to us than others, and some are more effective for shaping the structures and forms of ministry for the mission of the church, and we'll come back to that tomorrow.